I'm Mark Perkins, and this is with my colleague Elvira Richter. We would like to start this session. I'm sure that for an outsider first coming to this meeting, it may look a little bit like a meeting on the laboratory diagnosis of tuberculosis and lung disease, and drug resistance, thinly disguised as a conference on lung disease, because this seems to be the 10th or 15th session on TB diagnostics that's been this year. I think that can be attributed to the fact that there's a lot going on in the area, and it requires actually this many conferences to cover the exciting movements in the field. We have six interesting speakers today, and I will turn it over to Elvira to start the comments and introductions.
So, welcome, colleagues, to our session on the last day of the meeting. We have organized a meeting on the different rapid techniques today available on DST for TB. We have all heard about the problems if regular treatment fails, so we all know that we need to prevent transmission in case of resistant strains. We have selected several topics on phenotypic techniques, and we have one talk on genotypic techniques, and we also will have a talk on the implementation of these new techniques in high incidence, low income setting. So I think we have a good range of speakers here invited. And let me first start to invite Annika Kruner. She comes from the Mycobacterial Reference Unit from London, and she will give us a talk about liquid culture technique, the Midget BACTEC Midget 960 DST. Thank you, Annika, for coming.
So good afternoon, everybody, and I'd like to thank the organizers, first of all, inviting me to give this speech and also giving me this very challenging, actually, title. As you can see, in the end of the title, there's a question mark. So I hope that through this short presentation, we can finally answer to this question. So also, the first slide, I think you are more than familiar with all these WHO estimates, which are showing that there is 400,000 new MDR cases around per year globally, and the estimate is that 25,000 of them should be or are expected to be XDR TB. And classically, we know that to confirm multidrug resistant and extremely drug resistant, so you need culture-based techniques first to isolate the mycobacterium tuberculosis and identify, and secondly, to do the TST. It might be that in light of this conference, we can say that perhaps it's not very much true anymore for MDR, because nowadays we know that there is amplification tests available which are allowing us to actually to confirm MDR cases based on amplification tests. But it's still valid for XDR cases where we can confirm mostly with culture-based systems. And we also have heard a lot that actually to confirm all these estimates, we do have a little bit limited laboratory capacity available globally in this time point. And if we look to these policy guidelines, the WHO policy guidelines, you can see that there is the list of TB drugs which are in use at the moment for TB treatment. And you can also see that there is the list of methods which you can apply for actually measuring drug resistance to these drugs. And in this part of the table, you can see that there is the critical concentration which have been carefully established through these different multicenter studies for actually doing this job. Unfortunately, on the bottom of the slide, you can see for group 4 and group 5, the knowledge how to do in vitro drug susceptibility testing is still very limited. In my talk, I want to concentrate mostly with these two liquid meter systems, to demonstrate how these two tools can help us to actually confirm this estimate. So first question is, what this ideal or good testing technique should do? It has to provide accurate, safe, and quick results. And ideally, we need really so-called international universal standard operational procedure, so that we know that in the different parts in the globe, we do or measure the drug susceptibility in the same way. Also, we want to have that that the tests will be accurate, reproducible, and reliable, and we can achieve it through extensive standardization. Both methods, Midget and also the PACTEC, they are very well standardized. The package inserts are providing all information what you need about the product, also how, what to do, what not to do, and etc. The user manuals are very comprehensive. They explain you how to install the machinery, how to actually maintain it, and up to all this troubleshooting. And the most important thing, and I think the message is, that now there is the international SOP is available. And we have to thank for this international SOP, first of all, Professor Sabine Ruskertes and Dr. Salman Siddique, who have actually together published this SOP, or they put it together. It's very, very comprehensive, or let's say it's very useful, it's a very practical piece of work, and it explains everything for primary culture up to the TSD for first-line drugs, what to do, what to not to do, and it's easily accessible, it's on the FIND website. There's also a very important document which is coming out, it's WHO document, telling us this is the technical manual on second-line drug susceptibility testing, and the final version is under review at the moment. And this document is giving you also very detailed description. First of all, the list of second-line drugs, what do you think? We know exactly how to test and how to interpret the results. And secondly, which should be the techniques applied for doing this job. And also in this manual, actually, it's detailed to describe how to do the TSD second-line drugs using liquid media system. So if you want to know if the method of choice doing the right thing, if you want to know if your technique is accurate, reproducible, and reliable, I think the best thing is to go to check what is published about this methodology. And I think we are also very privileged because through the case, this liquid media system have been very carefully and very accurately evaluated. And if you look through the literature, check these published multicenter studies, and you can see that actually the design of the study is very precise and carefully chosen, and all these shortcomings are addressed. And also in multicenter studies, all these critical concentrations suggested are actually consensus concentrations. So you can also find out that actually they have been evaluated against different gold standard systems. So, and if you go through the literature search through Google or PubMed, you can find that there is a long list of actually studies, evaluation studies available to go into and check how they have, how these systems have been performing towards different drugs. And here's the list of studies where this first-line drugs susceptibility has been evaluated. And you can see here that I've just selected the studies in recent decades based off the study, the number of isolates actually tested, and also if this test characteristics was presented similar way. So it's obvious that actually if we look at this performance, sensitivity and specificity to streptomycin, we can see that actually through all studies we have very nice sensitivity and specificity results. The same is true for isoniazid and rifampicin. And if we come to ethambutol, you can say that through most of the studies the results are really very good, but there is one study where this is less good, and I will come back to that study because the study I know the most. On pyrazinamide testing, you can see also that sensitivity and specificity are really nice. Now, when it comes to second-line TSD testing, you can see that the list is much shorter. But again, we are very privileged because there is two multicenter studies where actually the critical concentrations were very carefully established. And also the comparison performance towards other test systems gave very highly reproducible results. And also the validation study where actually we tested 133 MDR cases showed that actually testing compromising, and the list where is highlighted the drugs here that gave very nice sensitivity and specificity for these drugs, almost as good as, or it is as good as for first-line drugs. But also you can see that there is, in the bottom of the list, there is some some new quinolones, which actually we do have publication where critical concentration have been established, but they haven't been actually validated in multicenter studies. So later on we can discuss these things here later if we have time. So concerning the biosafety, we all are very familiar with BACTEC for antigen system because it has been around for two decades almost, and we also know the limitation. The first limitation is perhaps that actually it is a hands-on system. That means that you have to do the reading to load the bottles and reload the bottles daily basis. So if you happen to drop the bottle, you might have huge spills outside of your safety cabinet. The other thing is that the label, radioactive label. We know that the radioactivity is not as high as it's not big health hazard, but actually the label itself actually makes it complicated for some countries to actually import the reagent, and also it might increase your radioactive expenses related to radioactive waste disposal. And also that we know that actually you are working with glass bottle, and it's sealed in the way that everything what you add to the bottle you have to add using syringes. So you have to do the risk assessment, and also you have to have SOP for SOP handling. The new version of the system is actually overcome all these limitations. This is hands-off system. As soon as everything is inoculated, you actually load the machine and you unload the tubes only when you have the full the testing is done. There is no radioactive waste, there is no shops, no glass. And the format is very handy as well. It's not too big, it's not too small. It's just, even if you do small pipetting mistakes, it don't actually influence your results. And the standardization is definitely one of the key points, and the standardization is actually already projected inside this, or incorporated to the, into the system, so since it is fully automated system. The good thing is that if you're working with too low inoculum or too high inoculum, you're not getting test results, like here, and you get only results if you're working in optimal conditions. Also, if you're working with mixed cultures or contaminated cultures, you're getting error message, and you have to go back and do the troubleshooting and retest this isolate. Also about the flexibilities. If you're lucky and you can also have this so-called epicenter system, which is actually very comprehensive clinical data management system, you can have much more flexibilities, and you can actually link this epicenter system to your midget systems. The important things what you get actually is that you can enter as many or as much clinical data or your specimens related data as you want. Also, it has very comprehensive reporting possibilities. You can create your reports, how and what you want to report, starting with the primary culture reports and including the, or ending with the TST results. And finally, what is the most encouraging is actually you can see the growth curves. So you can see how different. We know that some mycobacterial isolates, actually tuberculosis isolates, are growing or in different. They have different growth kinetics, and it's very helpful if you can actually monitor how they do during the testing phase. And the best news so far, what I can tell you, is that actually now this. There is new software soon available, and I think you all heard about this software already during on Friday when we had this find and the PT combined symposium. That new software, it's epicentering software, actually gives you the possibility to choose the list of third line drugs or second line drugs what you like to test, and also you can select the own critical concentration what you like to test, and you can always add more than one critical concentration. That was very good news, and the other very good news for me is that actually the new software allows you to prolong the window of doing the TST testing. That was actually the drawback for me 3 years ago when I ran this validation study in London. And the usually, or this might be considered the main reason why you had so low sensitivity when you tested ethambutol. The thing is that the previous software, actually, the window was 14, 14 days. And when we did the comparison to the resistant racer method, it was obvious that our very heterogeneous population, what was in our panel, actually started to play. And it was obvious that since the incubation period on solid media was longer, we saw in the end of third week that there are small colonies appeared on solid media, indicating that actually the resistant mutant to ethambutol occurred in later phase. So unfortunately, in the previous software version, we actually missed out them in the liquid media system. Now this new software is actually flexible. You can monitor the growth curves, and if you see some activity, you can prolong the window and you can do the job on a very accurate basis. Limitations. This is actually, I want to point out that actually this is the general limitations, and they are true for all culture-based techniques when it comes to TST for second-line drugs. We all know very well that the reproducibility, reliability is poor for some drugs, and especially for serine analogs and para-aminosalicylic acid. And we also know the correlation of second-line DST results with clinical response has not yet been adequately established. And of course, we are not happy at all that the knowledge what we have here is very limited. So I think we have to focus very much to the research to actually find out how we can, if we can, and how we can help the clinicians which, if they need to use this group 4 and group 5 class drugs. And the one limit for liquid media system is definitely expenses. It's a little bit too expensive, and you can see that in different settings the expenses are different. The good news for this conference is that actually Becton Dickinson has the different price lists for low-income and high TB burden countries, and I'm very happy that it might be that these countries have access to this very well-standardized and very handy system. So, coming back to my title, can I call that this liquid media system can be a gold standard for first and second line drugs? Let's go quickly through this checklist. Well, I hope that I managed to show you that Mitchell system is very accurate and highly standardized. I want to say that it's true, that it is safe, it is quick, it is easy to perform, it is flexible. Shared guidance at global level are almost available, and finally calibrated with representative samples of clinical isolates. Well, here I might say that if you're optimist, you say yes. If you are not optimist, you might say no. Based off the published data, you might say no. But I do know that there is a lot of unpublished data available. I know there is at least 4 labs in Europe who have been using Mitchell system for second-line TST for years, and the results have been very carefully evaluated or assessed with external quality control panels for second-line TST, and they have shown actually the performance very close to these evaluation studies. So this is actually supports my yes, and my very definite answer is yes, I think that we can call that these techniques can be golden standard for evaluation for other techniques. So thank you for your attention, and after this talk, everybody can stand up and explain voice their own opinion about this topic. Thank you.
So thank you, Annika, for this nice overview over the possibilities of the Mitchell system. Are there some questions on this topic? One or two possible? So, could you?
And something that has become in Florida. Very nice presentation. There are two issues I would like to address. In your summaries, where you list the critical concentrations and the various compounds and the number of strains, it would be helpful to have a similar summary where you actually also list how many resistant strains for this particular compound were tested. because for a capital, this is relatively rare, so maybe the statistical power may be different for a capital, since only a few strains are mono-resistant to capital, for instance. So that would be helpful. The second one, I'm certainly pleased to hear that there is now a revised software available compared to the Epicenter, because in the United States we have to pay $15,000 for the software alone. And so to have now something more modest, I think helps, because one really needs to monitor the growth curve, or whatever you would like to call this curve. But my question is the 15 days windows still hardwired into the current midget technology? In other words, you cannot longer incubate in the midget if your organism is not growing well. Mm-hmm. And there are three categories of organisms which usually don't grow well: multi-drug resistant strains, Mycobacterium bovis. Some countries still have bovis, they don't grow as well as TB, and therefore it would be nice if one would have the flexibility to say 17 days or 21 days, rather than by 15 days to be kicked out and say inconclusive.
Yeah, that's actually the new software, Epicenter-based software, actually is giving you the flexibility. You are the person who is defining how many days after 14 days you want to prolong your window. So actually that's, and you can revisit and see the curves, how they behave. So, and based off that you can prolong, and you can, perhaps I think you can prolong it more than once, so based off the things. So thank you for this very relevant comments. And concerning this, I think you pointed out very important things, that during the evaluation studies we have to know how many actually drug resistant cases or isolates are actually also tested. And our study was more channeled, our panel was more channeled. Even if it was UK-based, we actually, in our panel, we tested the isolates from Russia and Estonia, and they were MDR and XDR strain. So therefore, our core contents, as you remember in my slide, were actually were lower in the first place, because the software, with the, because of this limitation of the window, it didn't as you saw, that there, when this... the isolates were tested, compared liquid versus liquid system, and when less resistant strains were tested, it wasn't a problem. So, of course, it's very resistant isolates where there is already a heterogeneous population present. It's very important to have the software, or actually the tool, where you can actually quantify the drug resistance, and you can also define the intermediate drug resistance for some drugs and some isolates. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Then we will move on to the next talk. I want now also to ask the speakers to keep strictly in time. We have a full program, and we want to stay in time finally. So now I want to ask Juan Carlos Palomino, for his talk on nitrate reductase and colorimetric indicator assays.
Good afternoon, everyone. Juan Carlos Palomino. And I would like to thank the union for inviting me to speak a short overview of these two techniques, the nitratase reductase assay and the colorimetric indicator test. They are not from BD. They are not sponsored by FINE yet. But there have been interesting results going on, as you will probably see in the next slide. So, due to the limitations in time, I will go shortly about the fundamentals of these two techniques: a snapshot of the methodology, then a short overview of the studies and evaluations performed until now, a short comparison of both tests, and finally some quick conclusions. The nitric reductase assay It's a very simple technique, and it's based on the capacity of mycobacterium tuberculosis to reduce nitrate to nitrite. This has been known also as the Grease method, and it has been used since very long for the identification of mycobacterium tuberculosis. This is just to show you schematically the grease reaction based on the addition of two reagents to your tubes, and then you have a color compound that allows you to interpret the reaction as positive. So how the test is set up in the laboratory? You have the test is performed in lowest tangential medium, which is the same medium that you normally use for the proportion methods in many labs. Here, if you can, you set the test. Let's see if I can. No. Try this. If you set up your test for rifampicin and isoniazid, you test the same concentrations that are used in the proportion method. You have your control tubes. All tubes are inoculated with your isolate to be tested. 1 in 10 dilution for your ground control. And then you incubate this for 37 degrees for 1 week. Well, this is how the reaction looks in the real life. This will be an MDR isolate resistant to both RIF and INH. Here again, how the test looks. This would be a fully susceptible isolate, here fully resistant isolate, row control 2 to the left, and then one individual, in this case, one individual tube has been used for each one of the first line drugs. The one study that applied the nitrate reductase assay for a quinolone resistant, in this case was for ofloxacin, used a 7-ish 10 median, and then 2 micrograms of per ml of critical concentration. This will be a susceptible isolate, growth control, test tube, resistant isolate. Okay, in this table I have tried to more or less summarize all the studies published until now that have assessed the nitrate reductase assay. The first 12 studies have used the nitratase as an in solid medium as an indirect method performed on strains. Those shown in red, there are 4 studies, performed the test in liquid medium, trying to obtain faster results. Most of the studies have analyzed RIF or INH and RIF or the 4 first line drugs. One study tested resistant to ofloxacin. Sensitivity and specificity values have been reported from very good to excellent in most of the studies, especially for rifampicin and isoniazid. Lower values have been obtained for streptomycin and ethambutol in some of the studies. Time to positivity has been reported of about 10 days when performed on solid media, and around 6 days when performed on liquid media. The lower part of the table shows the 3 studies that perform the nitrotase test directly on sputum samples. The first one by Musa that was performed in Argentina evaluated the 4 first-line drugs. The second one by Asensio Solis in Peru assessed INH and RIF, and the most recent one by Afolabi in Benin assessed only rifampicin. Sensitivity and specificity values found in these studies directly application of the test on sputum samples have been somewhat lower than those reported for the indirect test, but it's still quite good for RIF and INH. There will be hopefully very soon a meta-analysis published about this, all the studies that has assessed the nitratase reductase test. Let's take a look now to colorimetric indicators assays. This is also a very simple fundamental. This is based on the reduction of a redox indicator due to the bacterial metabolism, and which produce a change in color that can be easily seen with the eyes. Several indicators have been proposed, with Alamar Blue, MTT, and Resazurin the most commonly evaluated. This is to show you just schematically how the test is performed when done in microtiter plates. several antibiotics can be tested at the same time. You can make dilution of the antibiotics in your plate. Then this is inoculated with the strain under study, incubated, and after 1 week incubation, your indicator is added. In this case, if it were rhizasturin, which is blue, when reduced, it becomes pink. If you use MTT, the same, from yellow to purple, blue. And this format also allows you to perform minimal, to determine minimal inhibitory concentrations. Here again to show you how the plate looks like before addition of the indicator added, incubation overnight, and then you see your colors. Colorimetric assays have also been performed in closed tubes. Here's one using MTT from the study by Abate. A more recent one using rhizasturin by the study of Coban. The same format. Okay, there was a meta-analysis published at the beginning of this year to assess the accuracy of this colorimetric method. And this meta-analysis identified 18 studies to assess resistance to rifampicin and 16 studies for INH. This meta-analysis find evidence of a high sensitivity and specificity of these methods. Although not part of the meta-analysis, several other studies have also been performed with colorimetric method to assess resistance to second-line drugs. From this same study, I just want to show you the forest plot that was determined. This is this case for sensitivity for rifampicin. A pooled value of 98% was found. Specificity for rifampicin, also a pooled value of 99%. Now, some of these studies have been also multi-center studies. We have heard from my previous speaker that the importance of having multi-center studies to validate this type of old diagnostic methods in general. So some of these include also multi-center studies performed. again, for the forest plot from this same analysis for showing sensitivity for INH, the pooled value was 98%. And specificity, again, 98%. Okay, so quick comparison of both methods. Nitrate reductase assay have been performed mostly on solid medium. There have been few studies that use a liquid medium format to detect to obtain faster results. Colorimetric methods have been performed mostly on liquid medium. There was one report with colorimetric assays using MTT for detecting drug resistance also. Indirect and direct nitrate reductase assay has been mostly performed as originally described in the publication of Angevin in 2002 as an indirect test with strains. The few studies that have performed this test as a direct test have performed in directly on sputums. The colorimetric tests have been mostly described as an indirect method on strain. Time to positivity has been reported at around 10 days when performed on solid media, 6 days when performed on liquid media, and 18 days when performed directly on sputum samples. Colorimetric assays, on the other hand, have reported time to positivity in 8 days. We can also consider that the nitrate reductase assay would be a method having a lower throughput because it is performed in tubes, and this limits a little bit the number of samples that can be, the number of strains that can be processed at the same time, or the number of drugs that you can test in the same test. Colorimetric methods, on the other hand, could be considered as a higher throughput because of its format when performed in plates is more easily feasible to test larger number of samples or many drugs at the same time, and it also allows more easily to determine minimal inhibitory concentrations. Nitrate reductase assay has also lower biosafety concerns because it's performed in closed tubes and solid media. Colorimetric tests are performed in liquid media and plates. So some rapid conclusions. And this is valid for both method, nitratase and colorimetric tests. Based on the published studies, they have shown good accuracy, high accuracy in detecting resistance for specifically for INH and RIF when performed as an indirect method. Somehow lower values have been obtained when they have been applied with directly on sputum sample, but still good accuracy for rifampicin and isoniazid. More studies are necessary to assess this direct application on sputum samples to have a better idea on this. Also, more studies are needed to assess both techniques on second-line drugs. The scarce information published has shown also good accuracy for detection of resistance on second-line drugs. And also, more evaluation would be desirable in target populations to assess the feasibility of implementation of these tests and similar tests and the routine condition, which is very important to know the application. And this is all what I have to show. Thank you very much for your attention.
So, thank you very much, Juan Carlos, for this comprehensive overview of these techniques, and also thank you for staying in time. Are there some questions to this talk? Would you take the microphone?
Thank you, Juan Carlos. I would like to know which are the contamination rates of the both methods.
Well, in our experience, have been low. That low means below 5%.
For solid and liquid.
I would say both in my experience and experience of close colleagues.
Thank you.
Carlos, if I can ask a question. One nice feature of these microtiter plates is that you can get an MIC from your liquids. What is the clinical utility of getting these MICs? How useful do you find them?
I leave that to you. There are more clinician than me. But, you know, when we apply of this thing, we have to differentiate. We're doing what? Diagnosis, we're doing survey, and that's this has also to do with the rapidity to obtain a result. Do we really need to have a RAT method that gives us the answer in one day? What is the difference to having an answer in one day, or in 2 days, or in 3 days, or in 7 days? I think that this is applicable to all tests. The same would be for the most studied, that first-line drugs, we more or less know correlation of in the case of tuberculosis, of course, correlation of minimal inhibitory concentration with drug levels attainable, but this is not very well known, but newer drugs, second-line drugs, and new drugs especially, so I cannot offer an answer about this and for the other drugs.
I just wanted to say, in answer to your last comment about how these methods perform under routine conditions, that in Peru, the nitrate reductase method is now being used in two public health district level laboratories and is being used, you know, for public the sector, and it seems to be working very well. You know, it's a simple method. The proficiency testing after the implementation have been good as well.
Amal Basili from WHO Eastern Mediterranean region. My question is to Dr. Carlos and also to the panel. In our region, some of the countries have a high retreatment rate. And of course, they are put on CAT2 regimens, and at the end, some of these will end up in failure. They are put, they become chronic TB, and then they discover that these are MDR TB. Do you think it's worth, using these rapid diagnostic tests for the retreatment from the very beginning or evaluating their use, do you recommend that? Also considering the low cost of these tests. Thank you.
I think, Mark, you have been involved in this study in Peru that took into account the results of these rapid intertreatments, so I think you better...
Yeah, the principal answer is that it's not really the speed of the assay that matters in getting retreatment patients identified as drug-resistant or not. It's doing an assay at all. It looks like that that it's reasonable, of course, to do drug susceptibility testing in any population that has a relatively high risk of drug resistance. It becomes cost-effective at MDR rates of 5% in the population. Now, cost-effective is a locally defined term, but you begin to save money by identifying patients in any population where there's a 5% prevalence. And that would include populations, for example, that were still smear positive in 2 and 3 months, which is one of the factors that we found in Peru. It's difficult to show a cost-effectiveness gain for a rapid test if you wait till very late to do it. The recommendations, I think, in general would be to perform drug susceptibility testing by a method anytime you suspect it, and ideally in populations where there's a greater than 5% risk, and to use a method that will get a result to the patient in some reasonable time frame, and ideally that would be in less than a few weeks.
Okay, thank you. And I think we have to give the microphone to our next speaker, David Moore, talking about the MODS assay, microscopic observed drug susceptibility testing, and I'm waiting for a talk how to perform this assay on drugs on susceptible and also on resistant strains. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you very much to the organisers for giving us the opportunity to present some information on MODS. I apologise to those of you who are in the Diagnostics Working Group meeting on Friday. Some of the slides I'll present are the same, not many of them, but some of them for the people who weren't able to make that meeting. I work in Peru at Cayetano Heredia University with a large group of people on behalf of whom I'm giving this talk, and most of the work that I'm presenting has been supported by the Wellcome Trust. And working in Peru on diagnostics is a blessing, because the National TB Program of Peru is renowned for being a very strong program, and this is a well-known paper demonstrating the considerable impact that a strong DOTS program had on the incidence of disease in Peru. And for that reason, it's been celebrated widely and notably by the WHO, amongst others. However, there's a phrase that's well known to most people who work in TB in Peru that's credited to a Dr. Julio Castro, which is that the program is good, but the disease is better. And these may turn out to be prescient words. This is the period that paper relates to, and we can see that in recent years, the gains in TB control that were affected by that strong DOTS program are starting to slow down. And moreover, I'm not going to show precise figures, but it's notable that whenever you look at maps of the global epidemiology of MDR-TB, that Peru is amongst the leaders, certainly in Latin America. Fortunately, Peru also had the good fortune to be one of the target areas for the Partners in Health group in the mid-1990s, who recognized that this was an emerging problem and pioneered their DOTS Plus strategy amongst other places in Peru. And therefore, there's a very good MDR treatment program in place, which is now in collaboration and largely led by the National TB Program. However, to harness the benefits of that treatment program, it's important that we have good diagnostics. And as Sonia's just explained, the National Program has the GRIAS method in 2 regional laboratories in Lima. And we're now part of an implementation project which aims to implement both MODS and GRIAS in a number of regional reference laboratories in the country, both MODS and GRIAS now being part of the National TB Control Policy. What I'm going to do in the 15 minutes that I have, is describe very briefly the MODS methodology for those of you who don't know it, and the key performance characteristics. All of this data is available, most of the data is available in a paper that was published this time last year and available on the website I'm soon to show you. I'm going to explain how the original setup of the MODS cultures has been streamlined somewhat based largely on that data. I'll give a little bit of preliminary data on extrapulmonary TB and MODS use, because we're asked that question a lot, and very briefly explain what you need to know to be able to do MODS. And then I'm going to answer three questions that we are repeatedly asked. The first is, this is liquid culture. We don't want to be playing with liquid culture because it's dangerous, isn't it? I'm hoping to explain to you that we don't think it is dangerous. Is it reliable? And I'll describe to you some of the efforts we're making to develop a quality assurance plan for MODS. And lastly, I'm going to suggest that there may be a future for rapid second-line drug susceptibility testing, although I'm far from suggesting that we know this to be the case yet. This is the website to which you can be referred if you miss anything that I say as I race through that, that list of objectives. I'm afraid the URL is rather complex, and although we soon hope to have this at modsperu.com, if you put modsperu into Google, you should find your way to this page in the end. Its home is at the Cayetano Heredia University website. And on this page, we have all of the MODS publications that have been published, not only by our group, but by other groups. And we have a photo library, which is one of the things we're repeatedly asked for. And here you can print out some posters, put on the laboratory wall to recognize the characteristic cording of TB, which is so central to the MODS methodology. Also, all the SOPs are on here, both for sputum and non-sputum samples, as well as the quality assurance plan. So there's three principles that underlie MODS, none of which are revolutionary. The first is, and we all know this, that liquid media supports faster and more sensitive growth of TB than solid media, so it's a liquid culture-based methodology. The second is that the characteristic tangles of Mycobacterium tuberculosis can be seen under a microscope much more quickly than any positive isolates can be seen with the naked eye. That's fairly obvious. This characteristic and very highly specific appearance in this media is central to the utility of MODS. And the final key to the MODS methodology is that we can do direct drug susceptibility testing by incorporating drugs into the assay from the outset. That is to say, we grow our sputum sample in the media, both in the presence and in the absence of drug, and if we have a positive culture in a drug-free well, then we can read the drug-containing wells. In a nutshell, this is how MODS used to be. The standard sodium hydroxide NAP decontamination method, we put 720 microliters in each of 12 wells. The mixture was there's no secret ingredients to MODS. The mixture was Panta, the antibiotic supplement, OADC, a nutritional supplement, and Middlebrook 7H9 media. And we had four drug-free control wells in the first incarnation of MODS, and two wells for each of the four first-line drugs you see there at two different concentrations. And I'll show you why we've been able to streamline this considerably since. So here are the key data. You don't need to look at the whole table. This table is in the paper as well. We had three different populations that we wanted to test this in, including patients with HIV. The importance of these numbers is that they're all the same, essentially, so it performs as well in patients with and without HIV. And these are the sensitivity data, and these are the specificity data. And for any culture-based methodology, the majority of what the specificity is about cross-contamination. In terms of sensitivity, MODS detected 98% of positive cultures out of the 3,757 samples that were cultured. MBBACT, automated liquid culture, also known as BACT Alert, detected 89%, and LJ detected 84%. These are the same samples. So it performs highly sensitively. What about the time? This is the graph that normally grabs the attention. These are cumulative frequency curves, and this curve shows the standard curve for Loewenstein-Jensen. The median time to culture positivity in Loewenstein-Jensen, these are both smear positive and smear negative samples, is 26 days, and there's a tail out to 55, 60 days, and that's what we'd expect. Similarly for MBBACT, the median time to culture positivity is about 13 days, and you censor your culture at 40 days. In contrast, for MODS, our median time to culture positivity is 7 days, and moreover, by 14 days, almost all of the cultures that are going to become positive have become positive, such that during this study, we were keeping our cultures till day 40, but we now discard our cultures after 3 weeks, after 21 days, because we know if it hasn't become positive by then, it's not going to. Sorry to repeat this one as well for those who were at the working group meeting, but this importantly shows that there's no significant difference between smear negative and smear positive sputum samples And all this data is from patients who are not receiving TB treatment in terms of time to culture positivity. So although you get a slight lag, which is probably not important in MBBAC-T, you don't get that with MODS. The median time is still 7 days. With MBBAC-T, you then have to go on to do your indirect drug susceptibility testing. That takes another 9 days. And if you do the proportions method on your Lowenstein-Jensen isolate, this is your time to get in your drug susceptibility data. In contrast, in MODS, it's the same curve. You get the drug susceptibility data the same day you get your positive culture. So basically, these two curves have moved to the right, and this one has stayed where it is. And that's obviously one of the benefits of direct DST, both in MODS and in the Grius method. How reliable is it? Well, I told you we tested two different drug concentrations. It turned out that there was one drug concentration for each of these drugs that was better than the other, so I'm only presenting the data here for that drug concentration, although it's in the online, the raw data is in the online appendix to our article if you're interested in looking at it. Suffice to say that for ifambutol and streptomycin, in the concentrations we were using, this methodology was not good enough. And we're exploring a range of different other concentrations, but I'm not expecting, certainly not expecting great things with ifambutol, and I'm skeptical about whether or not we'll get to a single critical concentration of streptomycin. When we looked at MDR detection at these concentrations, the kappa value, which is, of course, the concordance beyond chance of our MODS readout against what was a combined reference standard of automated MBBAC-T, direct DST and indirect DST and the proportion method, we got very high concordance, 0.93. Now, obviously, we'd like that to be 1, but the reality is that there's barely a study in the literature where one reference test compares with another reference test with a kappa of 1. So it does pretty well, 0.93. Sensitivity of 88.6%, which obviously is not 100%, and we'd like it to have been, but it wasn't. Specificity, however, is good. And in our setting, the negative predictive value of a MODS test that says you don't have MDR was 98.7%, and the positive predictive value was 100%. Cross-contamination is clearly an issue in the setup that I described. We've got two samples on a plate. We're dealing with a liquid media. So we undertook a fairly detailed evaluation of cross-contamination. Not fairly detailed, very detailed. We did some microbiological examination of the sputa that we had stored to check whether or not they regrew in the samples that we were suspecting may have been due to cross-contamination. We did we genotyped all of our strains and looked for patterns of same strain appearing on the same day of processing. And we also did some shoe leather epidemiology and went around visiting people who'd had positive cultures that hadn't been acted upon to see whether or not they'd gone on to develop disease. The bottom line from all of this was that we found out that on those occasions where, you remember, we had 4 wells for drug-free controls, on those occasions where we only had 1 colony-forming unit in 1 well, which we had previously been saying that was a positive culture, if we change the definition of our positive culture to we need at least 2 colony-forming units in at least 2 wells, we lost almost no sensitivity in terms of true culture positivity, but we improved the specificity of our test considerably, well, from 99.6 to 99.9, but we improved the cross-contamination rate from 3.3 to 0.7%. So now, if you get growth of 1 colony-forming unit in 2 wells or 2 colony-forming units in 1 well, that's a negative culture. It's also cross-contamination, which is a different issue which you need to explore. But our definition now of a positive culture has been defined by this study. And that's important. So we started off with a methodology that looked a bit like this. It had 12 wells, low and high concentrations of 4 drugs and 4 drug-free wells. And we've been able to take it down to one drug concentration for the 2 drugs that work and 2 drug-free wells, such that if we get a positive culture in both of these drug-free wells, then we can read the drug-containing wells. And now we've got 5 samples on a plate, and we've also got a column that we have as our negative control, which has everything in it except for a sputum sample. It has isoniazid in it, it has rifampicin in it, and media, but it doesn't have a sputum sample. And if we see any colonies growing in any of those wells, then we discard that plate and reprocess those samples. We're also now putting 900 microliters in a well, so it gives us a little bit more sample. So I'm just going to very briefly touch on performance of this assay in non-sputum samples. Maxine Kors in the center in Vietnam, which is renowned for work with TB meningitis, has been performing MODS on CSF and has had 133 positive cultures out of the 702 CSFs they've inoculated so far. Compared to a clinical case definition, that's people who were put on treatment for TB meningitis, the MODS assay came up as 65% sensitive, which is pretty good for any type of culture. And the median time to culture positivity was 6 days, which is certainly very good for CSF because the inoculum is obviously rather small. Marco Tavar presented this morning in the late breaker session the data that we hope will soon be impressed on the use of MODS for diagnosing pleural TB. Pick out the pleural biopsy sensitivity, which in this instance was 81% compared to 51% for LJ. Pleural biopsy has always been better than pleural fluid. And the time to culture positivity was a median of 11 days compared to 24 days for Lowenstein-Jernsson. What do you need to learn how to do MODS? Well, the SOP is reasonably self-explanatory. The media preparation is no more fiddly than any other media preparation, but it does need to be done carefully, obviously. And perhaps the key training need is the recognition of the pattern of growth. This is the characteristic cording pattern of Mycobacterium tuberculosis in the MODS assay. This is clearly different, and this is Mycobacterium avium intracellulare. This is Mycobacterium kansasii, also clearly different. And this is obviously fungal contamination. Now, it's not obviously that simple. You do need to spend a fair bit of time looking at a large number of cultures over 3 or 4 days. But after about a week of training, most medical students are able to read MODS plates. So if they can manage it, I would think that most other people are capable. Safety. Now, safety does seem to be a bit of an obstacle. And I'm hoping that by the end of this slide, you'll understand why we don't believe it's a big problem. Firstly, we're dealing with a direct DST. So we're not taking out aliquots of this liquid culture. Even if it's strongly positive, it's teeming with mycobacteria, we're not touching that liquid. As soon as we see that that's positive, we read the drug-containing wells, and we autoclave the bag. We're not going to open it up. We're not going to do secondary DST, at least in this methodology. So for that reason, essentially all we're doing is the risky part of this methodology is inoculating the sputum. And this data, which I was very pleased to see come out of Korea this year, demonstrated quite clearly that if all you're doing is inoculating culture and not doing what they mean here is indirect susceptibility testing, if you're not manipulating cultures, then your risk is no greater than if you're doing smear microscopy. Now, I wouldn't suggest for a minute that that means that you don't need a hood to do MODS. We think you should do it in a hood. But I think it does mean that you don't need biosafety level 3 to do this methodology. And simply, that's because we've put the plate in a bag, in a Ziploc bag. And if I drop this, I'm going to have to do 5 more cultures. But I'm not going to spill teeming mycobacterium cultures all over the floor. And I think that's important. These are plastic plates, they're not glass bottles. So we think that MODS is safe. And the bag didn't open. Okay, quality assurance. This is very important. And I'm glad to see that there have been a number of presentations about quality assurance in our laboratories, because clearly this is an essential part of the methodology. It's no good just doing the test if you don't know the results that you're giving out are correct. And I'm going to focus on 2 things to do with quality assurance of doing the test, but our quality assurance plan also includes the quality of the samples that are brought in, the methodology in which the samples are brought in, the state that they're in and whether they arrive on time, and also result delivery. Those are all important parts of our quality assurance plan, and it makes absolutely no sense at all to have a test that takes 1 week or 2 weeks or even 3 weeks if the whole of the rest of it, as has been shown very elegantly by the Partners in Health Group in Peru, takes another 5 months. So all of those things are important. With regard to quality assurance of our test, there are internal quality controls in the methodology, and I'll say a little bit about what we think is an appropriate level for external quality assurance. And you don't need to read all of this. I just want to pick out a couple of indicators. So as well as setting up our plate with our samples and our negative control column, every day at the end of sputum processing, we set up a positive control plate, which has a drug-sensitive and a drug-resistant isolate. And the purposes of that is to check that our isoniazid and rifampicin in our wells is accurately distinguishing between drug-sensitive and drug-resistant strains. So we will always have an MDR-positive control, and that must always grow. It must always grow through the isoniazid and rifampicin. And our drug-susceptible control must always not grow. And if it does grow, then we need to discard that lot and redo those cultures, because our isoniazid and rifampicin will not give us the right result. We want to know about the capacity of our media to support growth. And we have this positive control growth of both the MDR and susceptible in drug-free wells. And we want that always to be positive. We previously set ourselves quite a high standard here. We said that all smear-positive samples from patients not receiving treatment should be culture-positive. And I've become aware during this week that that's not only unrealistic, but probably overambitious. And I heard suggestions that maybe 90% should be positive. That seems to me a bit low. We're probably going to settle around about 95% because maybe some of those patients are taking medication or there's been problems with sample transfer. So these are some of the internal quality controls that are important, and clearly cross-contamination. I've mentioned the negative control wells. That needs to be 0%. If that's not 0%, then the system needs revising. And these aren't optional. This is all part of the test. You can't give patients results of these tests without this internal quality control being monitored. You can't just do it. You have to monitor it. In terms of external quality assessment, each setting is going to be slightly different in this regard. What we're planning to do in Peru is that we're planning to evaluate whether or not the detection sensitivity of MODs is at least 97% as good as whatever reference standard we use for samples that are externally checked, and that at least 97% of the samples which MOD says are negative are culture negative by reference methods. And similarly, we'll do similar thing for MDR, positive and negative predictive value. And this information is on the website. I'm nearly done, so don't cut me off. The Brontes are obviously a very famous literary family from England, and they grew up almost 200 years ago in England in a time when there was no treatment for tuberculosis. And there is some debate about the fate of each of the Brontes. It's generally accepted that Bramwell probably didn't die of tuberculosis, but almost certainly all the rest did. And very few of them, you'll see, got beyond their 40th birthday. Clearly, as we enter the era of XDR treatment, we're faced with a very similar XDR TB. We're faced with a very similar situation of untreatable TB. So diagnosing XDR TB is going to be extremely important so that we can get people onto treatment that is more effective. So we are repeatedly asked about second-line drug susceptibility testing for MODs. And it's interesting that we're asked this because conventionally microbacteriologists are somewhat resistant to direct drug susceptibility testing. They like to control the inoculum. And it's absolutely certain that this won't work for all of the drugs. However, we have started exploring the critical concentrations of drugs that might be useful for some of the second-line drugs. And this is work that we've carried out in collaboration with the Technical Unit for MDR Management in Peru. And I see Osvaldo Javi in the audience here who's been instrumental in making this a reality. What we've essentially done is we've taken 130, 140 samples now from patients receiving MDR treatment who've got a defined drug resistance profile using the proportion method in agar, which has been validated in the National Reference Lab, and we've incubated those samples in a range of concentrations of all of the second-line drugs that are available and used in Peru. I'm afraid I've deliberately obscured the names of those drugs here, not because I'm being secretive, but because this is not clean data, and these are not finalized curves, and I wouldn't like anyone to go away with the impression that such and such looks good, such and such looks bad. The bottom line is, once we've cleaned these data, once we've determined that those isolates in which we can't prevent growth, regardless of what concentration of the drug we use, are actually resistant and not, as we previously thought, sensitive, then we will be able to define whether or not there is a concentration which may be able to help us distinguish between susceptible and resistant isolates. And it's with those concentrations that we can then go on and do a prospective study, which will almost certainly need to be multi-center, to see whether or not MODS has any role in rapid second-line DST. And we're optimistic, but I would by no means be able to say that this is likely to be a reality. So, in summary, MODS is a rapid, reliable, liquid culture-based diagnostic test. Its performance is unaffected by whether your sputum sample is smear negative or smear positive, or by HIV status. The caveat to that is that all the data I presented here is in patients who were not on treatment. In patients receiving treatment, we have preliminary data which was published about, well, it's not preliminary data, we have published data from about 5 years ago, but it's in a small, uncontrolled study, and we need to do a much larger scale study in patients receiving treatment to verify that all of those performance characteristics are the same in patients on treatment. We now have what I think is a much streamlined four-well test. It still costs $2 a sample because of the price of everything else has gone up, but $2 a sample doesn't seem too bad for a detection and drug resistance assay. We believe it's safer than any indirect DST methodology, and our QA plan ensures a high-quality result output. We still need to think about how we would implement this test, and I think that applies to all new diagnostics, and there is some potential for rapid second-line DST, which we're evaluating. Thank you.
So, thank you, David, for this very excellent talk.
Are there some questions to him?
A quick question, David. What was your definition of cross-contamination? Because you, in the earlier version, you had 3% cross-contamination, but very high specificity. So how?
So cross-contaminated cultures were those in which the positive culture that we found was not supported by microbiological genotyping or clinical data. So what we had two samples from a large number of patients. Most of the patients who contributed two samples. If a patient was smear negative and only positive in one culture, then that was suspicious of cross-contamination. And it was in those patients who went back and we retrieved all of their sputum samples, we recultured them. Those that grew the same sample were same isolate, at least, genotypically identical isolate, we assumed was not cross-contamination of their original culture. It was the same. And the same with the
I have a question. Have you ever tried other drugs, not as direct test, but from culture, so to get better results for drugs like streptomycin and ethambutol?
What are you doing if
you have a resistant strain?
Yeah, we have done that. The published work on that is actually from Dick Chasen's group in Hopkins. They found that it worked slightly better for streptomycin and ethambutol, but it still is not good enough to recommend for wider use.
We'd like to move on to our next speaker, who will talk to us about phage-based assays for drug susceptibility testing, Heidi Albert, who spent her last 10 years of her life working on phage-based assays.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to talk this afternoon. So, as Mark says, my talk for today is about phage-based assays for detecting rifampicin-resistant TB. And I'm just to mention briefly at the beginning the two basic techniques we're talking about, phage techniques. The first one being phage amplification. I'm not going to go into detail because of the shortage of time, but just briefly, I'm sure most of you are probably aware, but this technique is based on amplification of the phage in rapid-growing helper or sensor cell, Mycobacterium smegmatis, and that's following the replication of the phage in viable MTB in the sample. The second basic method is Lux phage, and here we're looking at detection of light by the luciferase reporter phages. So those are the two basic techniques we're talking about. I'm going to very briefly talk a brief summary of some of the Lux phage data. This is taken from a very nice meta-analysis from Madhu Pai and colleagues in 2005. And this is just summarizing the studies with a Lux phage. And all of these studies done with this technique so far, the published studies at least are from TB cultures and not direct from sputum specimens. And you can see here generally the sensitivity is generally very high. Most studies, or in fact all of the studies here, really had a very low number of resistant isolates that were tested. But generally the sensitivity there very high, 100% or 92% in one study. The specificity, slightly lower than the sensitivity, but again fairly high. But really a limited number of specimens tested in most of these studies. And no data direct from sputum. So moving on, most of the talk is then going to focus on phage amplification for two real reasons. One, that I know a lot more about it than I do about Lux phage, but the second reason really that there's a lot more recent data and also more data direct from sputum. And really that's the way that drug susceptibility testing is going in terms of being able to really achieve rapid results. So the phage amplification method is a rapid method. Generally, in this talk, I've been asked just to talk about rifampicin resistance. So in that case, it generally takes 2 days for results. It's a manual method, and it basically requires the same sort of facilities you would need for a manual TB culture laboratory, so no other specialized equipment. There are both commercial and in-house methods, and I'm going to review some of the published data. And as I mentioned, that a number of groups have applied phage amplification technology to drugs other than rifampicin, but I'm not going to talk about that today. So in reviewing the work that's been published on phage amplification, it's very striking that there's an awful lot of variations in the way that that the technique's been applied. And I've just listed the key ones here. The first one is the test format, and by that I mean the commercial FASPLAC method, and a number of other groups doing in-house methods use a single tube, and a number of other groups are using a microwell plate format. The second real difference is the rifampicin concentration that's used. And again, generally that's usually between about 4 and 10 micrograms per mil when it's an indirect method from culture. And some groups choose to use one concentration, others use multiple concentrations. And when the testing is done directly from sputum, a higher concentration is used, and that's generally 10 micrograms per mil. Though I'll mention later, one of the published papers did use a lower concentration. And then the third area in which there are major differences in the methodology is really the endpoint detection and the way that the results are actually interpreted. So you have a number of different ways that can be done. The first one would be a single cutoff number of plaques. So in order to discriminate between resistant and susceptible, you would actually have a single cutoff. Below that would be, below or above that would define the resistance and susceptibility. Other groups use a proportion of the number of plaques in the drug-containing versus drug-free sample. For some of the sort of methods where the reaction mixture is spotted onto an indicator plate, there it could just be the absence or the presence of lysis. And then another study published recently used a colorimetric endpoint. So this table is really just lots of numbers, but basically to summarize the data from using phage amplification from cultures. And I've separated this into two areas. The studies at the top are using the commercial FASPLAC method, and the bottom studies using in-house methodologies. And just maybe to mention that most of the earlier studies were those summarized in the meta-analysis, and so there are a number of much smaller studies that are not included here, but those really contain very low number of particularly resistant isolates. So I've just chosen to include those with larger sample sizes, and then also added some of the more recent in-house methods. And you can see here, again, similar to the Lux phage data, generally the sensitivity is very high, really with the exception of this one study was only 81%, but other than that one, generally very high sensitivity. The specificity is also in most of the studies quite good, but there are a number of studies where the specificity, in this case 74%, there's a couple of studies in the 80%, and the rest of them are sort of above 90 and quite a number above 95%, but quite a range there. The thing I should just mention that this slide doesn't really take into account is what I was mentioning on the previous slide, is that in looking at these, there are a whole number of differences in the individual groups and the combination of the cutoffs that they used and the concentrations. So it's really quite difficult to, this is really summarizing all that sort of put together, but it doesn't really pull out those individual factors. And this is just the meta-analysis that I mentioned by Madhu Pai and colleagues. This was their conclusion in 2005 that the current evidence for phage-based detection of rifampicin resistance is largely restricted in culture isolates. And when used on culture isolates, these assays appear to have high sensitivity, but variable, slightly lower specificity. And even with those few more recent studies, that's still a valid conclusion. So moving on just to talk about some of the more recent work directly from sputum, which, as I say, that's really what we're aiming at. And this is a slide for the commercial assay, the FASPLAC response assay from Biotech Laboratories. And this is just showing the workflow. And essentially, the assay uses smear-positive sputum, so 1 plus smear-positive or greater. It's processed using the NALC sodium hydroxide method and just one additional wash step, and then incubated overnight with and without rifampicin. And then the phage amplification step is then done. And for interpretation of results, as I mentioned, the different methods, this just uses a cutoff, or a single cutoff number of plaques for sensitive and resistant. So the test altogether, the results within 2 days from the specimen. And here, just to mention, here's just showing the resistant strain, and there's greater than or equal to 50 plaques is showing that that's resistant, and a susceptible one, less than 50 plaques. So it's a very straightforward interpretation. Then this study, this slide is just summarizing the data on phage amplification direct from sputum, and all of the studies mentioned here are using the commercial FASPLAC method. So there are no published data available, certainly that I've come across, using the in-house methods direct from sputum. So summarizing these, just to mention the first study at the top from Pakistan, this did use the commercial kit, but actually used a lower concentration of rifampicin and didn't use the interpretation criteria that are recommended by the company. Those results are slightly different, a lower sensitivity and specificity than the other studies had shown. And there could be some clear reasons there why that is the case. The other studies, three in South Africa and a fourth study in Peru, just to mention firstly the South African studies. Here the sensitivity was pretty high, ranged between about 93% and 100% in the initial small study. The specificity ranged between just nearly 96% and 100%. And really the one factor that I'm going to mention in a moment is the percentage of interpretable results. And it's something that's not really talked about very much, especially with this sort of direct testing. You know, what actually is your yield of usable results? And this was something here, this ranged in the bottom study 69% and up to a maximum of 83%. So really that's one area of concern. The study at the bottom is a study by TDR and FIND with Peruvian partners, and the FASPLAC assay was included in that study. And the sensitivity there was almost 95% and also about 95% specificity. And in line with these other South African studies, the percentage of interpretable results was also quite low, was about 75% in the initial part of that study. So, as I mentioned, the level of interpretable results is really a concern, particularly when you want to implement this sort of test routinely. And in the phage amplification assay, this is the loss of results or uninterpretable results is really due to two causes. One of those is that there just aren't sufficient plaques in the drug-free control to enable you to interpret it. And that's obviously very similar to proportion method, that you need adequate viable TB in the control tube. And this, it's been hypothesized, this could be a number of reasons. It could be inhibitors of phage infection that are present in the sputum. It could be due to the metabolic state of the TB. The second main reason, and I should just mention with the current assay, it's very difficult to change that. That's usually a fairly constant proportion. The contamination is the other main reason, and something was done to address that, largely following on from the large study in Peru and the contamination that was experienced there initially, and also from other studies in South Africa. So initial contamination without the antimicrobial supplement was 14% and 19% in Peru. This so-called NOAA supplement, which contains nystatin, oxacillin, and aztreonam, was specifically developed to be compatible with the phage, so as not to inhibit phage infection of the TB and not interfere with the discrimination of susceptibility. And this was very successful. And in a subsequent Cape Town study, without the antimicrobial, it was 14% contamination. That was reduced down to 4%. And in Peru, a follow-on study where the supplement, the NOAA supplement was used, contamination was only 1%. And this led to 88% and 90% of interpretable results, which is much more favorable. So following on from the evaluation data in Peru, the...
You have 5 minutes.
The phage assay was then to become part of the demonstration projects, which are collaboration between FIND and MRC and NHLS in South Africa. And the objective of these is really to assess the feasibility and impact of rapid assays for MDR screening under operational conditions. The phage assay was initially validated in two of the laboratories in South Africa, and this is really as a sort of pre-validation phase to ensure that that the different assays that we're implementing can be validated locally prior to the large-scale use. Unfortunately, the phage assay didn't meet those initial target specifications in those two laboratories, and so FIND has had to put on hold the demonstration assay for the demonstration project for this assay in South Africa and in the other sites that we're under planning. And currently, the manufacturer is looking into the reasons for the poor performance, and then obviously remedial action. So just in conclusion, the phage-based testing for rifampicin resistance does have potential and a lot of interest still, the potential as a low-cost and a relatively low-tech method. Certainly it could be further simplified from where it is right now. However, most data, and especially the data with the groups looking at in-house methods, are from cultures and not sputum. So there's really very limited data from sputum. And as I mentioned on the previous slide, there are still a number of issues that need to be addressed regarding the test performance. Thank you.
Thank you, Heidi. Are there any questions? Armand?
Armand van Deun from the Union. I was just wondering, because the main performance problem seems to be specificity to me. If you have these specificities in low prevalence countries, it's useless. So, on the other hand, I know that one of the last studies you showed on cultures by Hamidou Traore from Uganda, they resolved some discrepancies by molecular testing, and they found that, in fact, the phage assay had given resistant and that there were RPOB mutations present, but that the reference technique had given susceptible. So I wonder how many of these studies have used molecular assays as the reference, while, like Max was alluding to earlier, some very difficult strains are around, and the reference method may have missed them. Phage methods, to me, they have an appeal in the sense that they don't depend on the grout of the mycobacteria. And like Max was saying, these very slow growers, as long as there is some metabolism, there might be an advantage in these tests.
Yeah, some of the earlier studies from TB cultures, there were similar things found to what you're saying. So there were a number that were resistant on the phage method but susceptible with conventional, but when we looked at we found unusual mutations. One of the studies that I mentioned did, I think only one out of the recent studies did look at that, but I think certainly the Peru study there was testing by genotypic methods to sort of cross-check with both the conventional methods and the number of other methods that were being evaluated. So I think that the recent data that from South Africa, I think that is unlikely to be a large part of the...
It's not resolving so much.
No, I don't think that is the case.
Okay.
the sequence data from RPOB and in the large Peru study found about equal numbers of false phenotypic and false phage results in terms of, so about half of the discrepancies were due to inappropriate phenotypic results.
Okay, thank you.
Ruth McNally, London School of Hygiene. Thank you for a nice overview. My question isn't really about the phage assay. It's about how we report. And it's about the phage and we're seeing in the back tick. If you've got a lot of contamination, you're not getting a result in 25% of your tests. Should we be saying we've got 95% specificity or 900% sensitivity? Or should we look for another way of expressing those results that warn people, actually, you're only getting a result in 75%, maybe you're only getting 75% sensitivity rather than 100%? Because we see headlines, we see read abstracts, we just read the sensitivities and specificities. When you dig a bit deeper, you sometimes think, well, actually, the reference method gave 100 results, and we only got 75 results. I'm just wondering how we can get around that. We're used to talking about sensitivities. Maybe we need a slightly more sophisticated way of expressing results.
I think the more sophisticated way is to talk about reportable results and then sensitivity and specificity as independent numbers as they are. You have to just read the whole abstract, I think. Okay, thank you very much, Heidi. Our next speaker is Doris Hillman, who will speak to us about the possibilities and limits of molecular assays for drug resistance.
Yes, good afternoon. First, I'd like to say thank you to the organizers that they give me the possibility to help this presentation. I'd like to talk on limits and possibilities of molecular assays. And one I would say at first is that the molecular analysis of drug resistance in Mycobacterium tuberculosis is based on a simple principle, and that is that all drug-resistant strains have mutations in distinct genes that we only have to recognize. Okay, we are now in the really lucky position that we can get these results within 24 hours, and theoretically, these methods can be universally applied to all drugs. One of the essential prerequisites is, however, that we have to have the knowledge of all these resistance-associated mutations. And there's a lot of work done before in lots of studies before, and there are lots of genes already recognized, lots of targets found that are associated with drug resistance in Mycobacterium tuberculosis. The most famous is the RPOB gene, and here it is a 81 base pair hotspot region that is the most famous, and most studies are performed on this region. If you, for example, target the RPOB gene, then you are able to detect more than 90% of all drug-resistant strains. But if you want to implement such a technique in your own country, you have to do your own study, and this we have also done. We have looked at the 81 base pair hotspot region, and we have found, as in most other studies before, that we have the most prevalent mutations in three codons, the 516, 526, and the most prevalent in the codon 531. Totally, we could detect with this investigation 99% of all rifampicin resistant strains. Only one strain had a mutation outside this region. And looking at isoniazid, we first looked at the CATG codon, and in this codon we found 88% of all resistant strains. We further looked at INHA and AHPC, and further in total 5% we could detect looking at these two target genes. And only 7 strains had no mutation in these targeted genes. So how can we get all these results? And I have some methods listed here. The gold standard for DNA for detecting resistance-associated mutations is the DNA sequencing method. It is the gold standard because you can get 400 to 500 base pairs of raw data of your target genes. A disadvantage is that this technique is costly. Therefore, an alternative is the pyrosequencing, with which we can, however, only get short DNA sequences, short fragments. Okay, there are two other techniques with which you can detect mutations. One is the SSCP analysis, and the SSCP analysis is based on the generation of single-stranded DNA, and you can detect mutations when you made them visible on the gel electrophoresis. Specific mutations you can find with the PCR plus RFP method because specific enzymes cut the DNA at specific sequences. Okay, I come to two more popular methods, and these are the real-time PCR methods and the PCR plus hybridization methods. The first real-time PCR method is based on the detection with fluorescently labeled probes, and different formats are available. One is the molecular beacons, the hybridization probes, and the Tecman assays. And on the right side here, you can see an example for hybridization probes. After the PCR run, you perform a melting curve analysis, and doing this, one can distinguish between wild type and mutated sequences because of different melting temperatures. Okay, then using Tecman assays, we are now able to detect single nucleotide polymorphisms, and this we have performed for the CATG codon 315 here shown. The last method that I want to show is the PCR plus hybridization. There are some kits available on the market. This is the InnoLipa targeting the rifampicin resistance. This is the genotype MTBDR plus targeting rifampicin and isoniazid, and we have heard a lot about it. But there are also some DNA SHIP assays available that mainly target also isoniazid and rifampicin. So I only want to show this as an example here. The interpretation of genotype MTBDR plus is based on the differences of wild-type patterns. If there is a difference from a wild-type pattern, then we can see this as an indicator for a resistant strain. These techniques are all evaluated deeply with cultures, but we wanted to know whether this technique is also applicable on direct samples, and we performed a small study with 72 sputum smear-positive specimens, and this collection included susceptible strains and resistant strains. And we could clearly show that this technique is also applicable on direct samples with a sensitivity for rifampicin of 96.8% and isoniazid for 90%. So now we are completely fine with this technique. We can apply it on direct samples, but one must be aware that there are some limitations of these techniques, and especially if we have we want to replace all culture methods by these molecular techniques. If doing this, we have to perform lots of assays if we want to apply it to all drugs. For example, for streptomycin resistance, we have to target two. For isoniazid, at least three. And I guess if you have the best knowledge, in the world, there will remain some unknown resistance mechanism, and we will not find all resistant strains with these methods. And one must be very careful applying these techniques because there is a certain risk in the laboratory of contaminations. And I don't mean bacterial contamination, I mean contamination with PCR products. And everyone who has worked with PCR knows how difficult it is to get rid of this contamination. Sometimes PCR fails, or this is mainly because of inhibitors in the specimens. And there's another problem I want to point out, and this is one of the mixed populations. And here are several examples where we found mixed populations, and not all techniques are good for the interpretation of mixed populations. I begin with the baddest one, and this is the real-time PCR here shown. One can clearly distinguish between mutated sequences and wild-type sequences, these and these. But if you have a mixed population, you get a broad peak, and there is no result interpretable at all. So it could be a test failure or whatever. A little bit better, it works on it works with the Tecman probes. Here we have a mixture of a wild type and a mutated sequence, and we can clearly see two signals in our assay. Also, it is possible to detect mixed populations with sequence analysis. You can see here a double peak. So this is an indicator that we have two sequences, so two strains. For me, the best analysis for mixed populations is with the hybridization assays shown here, because here you can see not only the wild-type banding, but also the banding for a mutation. Okay. But I have more limitations. There are, all these techniques are mainly evaluated for cultures. There's no deep evaluation for smear negative or for smear positives. There are rare evaluation, and there are nearly no evaluations for smear negative specimens. And what is available on the market? There are no commercial standardized assays for all drugs available on the market. And I don't want to get into the cost and equipment discussion, because we've all heard that all the other techniques are not for nothing. So, but on the other hand, there are lots of possibilities with these techniques. And for me, one of the best thing is that we don't have to handle with bacteria, with microbacteria. So if they are inactivated, we only handle with DNA, and there's less biohazard risk, and this is obvious. Automation is possible. One can increase throughput in a laboratory. And with the DNA sequence on our hand, we have often more and additional results than compared to the culture techniques. And also my opinion is that these results are more reliable than conventional drug accessibility testing. But I come to one of the most important ones at the end, and this is the rapidness of these techniques. In the best case, we have our result within one working day. And this has some important, or can have some important consequences. We have then a really early knowledge for the correct therapy, and we are able also to use this as to interrupt transmission chains, and that is really important in case that we have an MDR strain. And I want to end up with a question or an idea, whatever, and this is it is the idea that if we have detected a rifampicin susceptible strain by a molecular method, then having in mind that rifampicin resistance is an MDR marker, we could we forget the conventional DST at all for those cases? Thank you.
Thank you very much for that overview. Do we have any questions?
No question.
Especially when you have the mixed types in the strain, wild type plus a mutation, it is limited to the mutations you have on the strip. Sometimes you will not recognize if you have a weaker band in the wild type and no additional representation on the strip. So the biochip will give more information.
Yes, you're completely right. The only thing is that the combination of two rare mutations is very rare, and the combination of a mixture having a wild-type sequence and a very rare mutation is also rare. So in most cases, we'll get a good result with this.
Thank you. Knut, now that you're already standing, perhaps we can ask you to go ahead and start your talk. Thank you very much.
Knut will talk to us about the implementation questions on DST techniques in high incidence, low income countries.
So, thank you very much. I think this is more a cross section from history to the present because I rely a little bit on a 22 year old project when we started in Nepal. So, DST is implemented mostly in laboratories which are the apex of a pyramid, and it covers a population ideally between 1 and 10 million, but often on it is much more, to 25 million people. So you need specialized TB bacteriology laboratories because you are handling high concentrations of viable germs of risk group 3. With the strengthening, the central reference laboratory has to be strengthened above the basic levels in terms of code of practice, laboratory design and facility, laboratory equipment, health, medical surveillance, and staff training and retention plan. And the biosafety levels are in between 2 and 3. These are the markers or the properties that the laboratory has to have between level 2 and level 3. It concerns the location inside of the laboratory compartment, which should be at the end, out of the traffic. It should be sealable. The ventilation has to be directed. Double door entry is somehow to realize. Autoclave should be available, and biosafety cabinets should be always available. So the functions of a central laboratory, what you have to ask for to address for DST is the education and training in biosafety, the policy on culture and identification and drug susceptibility. What has to be organized also more and is very important is the supply and maintenance when you organize such a laboratory, the reliability on regular and safe specimen transport, and if you do not have rapid and effective communication of the results, why doing it so quickly, and integrated internal and external quality assurance. And the link to a supranational reference laboratory is necessary or obligatory when for QA, EQA, when you perform DST results for WHO. So with the NTP, the criteria to request for or to perform, when to perform a culture in DST will influence your calculation on staffing, training, and funding of this laboratory. So the types of DST we have heard in extenso, when you have the viable ones, then you compare the growth of metabolism in a more general way. That means production of CO2 or consumption of O2. And more specific, you look for the activities of dehydrogenases or nitratase or something like this. The critical part is really that you, or the critical concentration you use is in comparison wild type between the control with the other drug-containing cultures. The problem is that they depend on viable germs, and they should grow similar in the non-drug-containing and the drug-containing media, because when you have a difference, then you have also a difference in the metabolism. So the genotypic test is the detection of mutations, and we have heard we have to know them, and we have the problems that we have multiple genes and unknown mutations and silent mutations. That means we detected mutation and it codes for the same amino acid, then it will not be detected at all. So what we did when we started the conventional methods in Nepal, we gave a good training on the proportion methods. We looked for the drug powder quality. This was supplied. We looked for the storage. We taught them how to look periodically for the expiration dates. We give them the potency of every drug we deliver, because this may change from batch to batch. So then we looked about how they dissolve it and how they dilute it. The medium preparation, especially the duration of heating and the heating itself, and of course the storage, never too long. Internal quality control with the H37RV strain. And for the proportion methods, the reading between for four and for six months. So then the critical part is really, for all the methods, the preparation of the suspension. And what I have seen in many laboratories is that they make it in an open bowl and do not even change the gloves. And the real or the best one is in a closed Pyrex tube with glass beads, so that this preparation gives less aerosol. So the other point is the inoculation size. You can choose between 10 microliter with a calibrated loop, and in most of the prescriptions you have 100 microliter to inoculate. So in Bolivia, we were not able to use the 100 microliter because there was a rest of liquid down, and when you shake it or move it, you get more colonies, and this was not very convenient. The other thing is you give them a precise SOP, and we have written our SOPs in that way that from one batch they get all the media containing the drugs, including the dilutions needed for the quality internal quality control, so that the rest of the batch is used for the control. So the control is always related to all the concentrations and drugs they use. When we had set this up, this laboratory performed culture in DST according to the proportion method since 1987. It passed all the EQCs successfully. In the meantime, they have performed more than 15,000 specimens for all the four drugs, participated in all four rounds of the WHO IOTLD, and participated in Study A and Study C of the Union. They perform DST on second-line drugs since 2003, and all laboratories' investigations for the DOTS Plus program, which is now above 300 patients already, is done in this laboratory. So about the difference between liquid media and solid media, I can skip, I think. And when we introduced liquid media in form of the midget in as a feasibility study in Nepal, we faced a lot of problems. You can get high-tech, but you have to use low-tech to roll it in on water pipes like this. Then inside of the palette, you have really heavy metal boards where you can get it out. But when you try to level it, you have to make your own water balance to get it straightened. The next what you see is in these areas, you do not have electricity all the time. Twice a week, they shut it down for 3 hours, and you have to find a solution to keep this machine running. And the solution was, I asked for a UPS, but what they sent was a UPS, just good enough for 5 minutes to run a computer, not this machine. So we looked at the local market, and with the help of 16 lorry batteries, we got the capacity to run this machine constantly. So switching to liquid media, you need a safe laboratory in all aspects. You have to give a special training on the stuff, and you have to find the agar medium because you have to look for the contaminants, and it was not possible to prepare a simple blood agar there because you don't have sterile blood. So we switched over to brain heart infusion agar and use this instead. So the maintenance has to be organized from outside, and the stability of the electricity is always a big question. So the lessons learned. We had several delays in the delivery, so it's not only the delivery, it's a shipment, and most difficult sometimes the custom clearance. And this you have to consider when you think of buying and running this machine. Some reagents, and it is for unknown reasons, I don't know why, it is a MicroPrep, which has a very low short shelf lifetime, and when it arrives, you have sometimes only a few months left to use it up. Therefore, you have to have an inventory management, and you have an ordering system which will allow you to keep everything online and do not get a disruption on supply. So the DST, we learned also our lesson. It's not enough to check the suspension you use for inoculum. There are sporadic contaminations inside which will result in a false resistance report. So at present we are checking all positives, including the positivity of the control on the brain heart infusion, and the correlation between the conventional method and the midget method and some molecular biology test was only 90%, and we need to reach above 95%, otherwise something is wrong. So, okay, this test is already known, and we introduced it 3 years ago. And the new version includes already INH resistance in two parts of the gene. And as said, this test was developed from specimen to culture and use it from culture, but you can go from specimen also directly to culture. And here you see repetitive samples. It's reproducible. And you see the mutations. Okay, for those who are able to read it, all these three parts have mutations somewhere in between, because it's not only the wild type, you see also the mutations here. And when we did this with the ongoing DOTS Plus program, and this all was done in Nepal, it was not done in our laboratory. Yeah? These were the people there who did it. We realized there were 7% put on DOTS Plus, which had non-tuberculous bacilli, which is Mycobacterium fortuitum three times. They got cured because it contains a fluoroquinolone. There were three Mycobacterium intercellulare. One was still positive after 9 months, and the abscessus also. So not all MDR patients in the DOTS Plus program are MDR patients. So when we now compare the conventional results with the genotype results, we found there is absolutely no difference between the results of RMP between the two methods because all had a sensitivity of 98%. These are the orange ones. The only difference is in the INH, and it is clear because we missed 23 wild types. They were resistant. So this 23 compared to the 272, it's a little bit less than 10%. So the prevalence of this gene, the Kajil gene, is 83.4%, and the INHA gene is 17.9% in this population. And when you sum it up, it's a little bit more than 100% because three of the strains we found had a double mutation in Kajil gene and INH gene, which is very low. So the additional contribution of the INHA gene in this part of the world is really good. The other advantage to have the INHA gene mutation strains identified is because it is associated with the proteone or etionamide resistance, and we checked them on Löwenstein-Jensen. They all were resistant, but on the midget with 5 micrograms, this is the last recommendation, they were not all. So we missed 25% with this concentration. The other technique is you put your sediment or sputum directly on a filter, lysed or non-lysed, as we have seen, and go through the whole process. And we did several different assay small studies to find out how far we can go to simplify the whole method. So from the sediment, lysed and non-lysed, down to the sputum direct on this filter method. And I will tell you only about the one from the Petrov method, because this is more important to you. So what we saw, we used it and left the alkaline, the rest alkaline in. So the hydrolysis of the cells is much faster. We had no inhibition and good yield. And what we did, we used two different devices, one with 1 millimeter diameter and one with 2 millimeter diameter, which means it's a fourfold area. And after amplification, we saw most of the samples had the same intensity in hybridization. So 47 samples were identical, but 15 showed some differences. 4 were better with the 1 millimeter, but 11 were better with the 2 millimeter size. And there was no detectable carryover because I knew from the conventional method how to do it, to arrange it to get different hybridization patterns. So we couldn't find any cross-contamination. And the most challenging thing is, like addressed the mixed patterns where you have wild type and you have the mutations, or you find the mutations. And we had in this set, we had 8 of them. 6 were resistant and 2 were tested susceptible in the conventional method. So in summary, it was able in this laboratory to introduce the proportion method on LJ for first and now for second line drugs with reliable result and sustained external input was needed. This means we had to come once or twice a year for 2 weeks to set up and look after everything in the laboratory. So the genomic tests were surprisingly easily learned. So this didn't cause too much troubles, but we gave them an intensive care training on how to use the equipment and how to handle the waste. So, for instance, we have no possibility to suck out the after hybridization this mixture. So we took a little plastic bowl, which we use normally for spraying distilled water. We took it up so that we pressed air out, and inside we had some bleach, and we sucked it out like this here, so it was immediately in the bleach. So with little things you can improve this and hinder the spread of amplicons. The use of liquid media caused more problems, so the contamination rate was one. This problem is solved. The occasional contamination in DST tubes, this is under investigation, as I told you. The maintenance and technical support, so we get it from India, from Delhi, which means within 2 days a person can come and look after things if something is happening. This is quite good. So troubleshooting we do by email or on the spot. During this time we have been 4 times in the laboratory. That's a must. And the adjustment of the SOPs, this is an ongoing process now. We have to learn a little bit more about this. On the other hand, there is the, what's that called, the hand method of Midget. And if you have too much troubles with the machine, one could switch to this possibility. It was done in our laboratories for 3-4 years before we had the machine, so it's also a possibility. Thank you for your attention.
In the 1980s, it became clear that simply giving patients bags of drugs and sending them home would not result in good cure rates. And WHO took the extraordinary step of implementing, in the early 1990s, a DOTS program under which all patients got supervised drugs for however many months it took. It's also clear now that phenotypic testing for drug susceptibility is not easy as well, and that the same kind of care will need to go into laboratory systems to allow that to happen on a broader scale if we want to achieve it. And we can't leave laboratories to be the afterthought in the diagnostic care programs. We have a few minutes for discussion if anyone has questions on any of the issues that have been raised during these talks. Ahman.
Yeah, sorry, it's me again. So Doris was saying maybe molecular can replace, or it can be sufficient when you have a susceptible result that you would not have to do the DST. But would you agree on that, Knut?
I think when you have 91% chance to get it on the spot or very easily done, sending killed bacteria from the remote area on a filter to a central place, this would be very, very helpful. From these areas to get the specimen, you know, the problems with sending them in time and without too many contaminations, I think it could be helpful. I analyzed also the 9% which we didn't get. They were RMP resistant. When they were RMP resistant and we would have relied only on the RMP resistance, we would have missed 2 of the MDR strains. Yeah. So, yeah. When you say you get a wild type because it was not Kaji gene mutated and it was not INHA gene mutated, these were 23. And out of them, 21 had also an RMP resistance. So when you look, when you see it's a wild type and you look to the RMP resistant, you should put them on another treatment. So when we can get more data from different parts of the world, we could adjust the algorithm a little bit.
But only looking at RPOB, there is like 5% for the LIPA test, at least 5% is missed. And
you mean by the RMP, yeah?
Yeah, the RPOB, no, the line probe
test. In Nepal, it was only 98% we found. We missed only 5 out of the 272.
But we had recently a large series from Kinshasa. We had some there that are clearly outside the range of the core, the 81 base pair. So you had the 535, you had the 572, several. So I'm not sure if we can do without phenotypic.
It was only one in this whole set, yeah, which is phenotypically resistant at the 533 mutation, I think. Huh?
No, but that's covered.
Yeah. The question may not be, can we stop doing DST and instead use molecular? The question may be, we're currently detecting 3% of drug-resistant patients by doing DST because only 3% of patients have access to it.
if we can. So the question is, can we make DST more accessible by using molecular techniques to those patients who are not currently infected?
That absolutely. That's no question to me, that we need molecular if we want good accessibility. But still, people have asked also in other symposia, can we now just set up molecular and forget about a backup system of TST? And there, I think it's a bit rushed to do that.
I want to say that I don't want to set up a gold standard with these molecular techniques. It's only a solution if you have limited resources, and then that's with these methods you can achieve lots of results with really low cost and low energy, and it's as we've seen, it's easy to implement everywhere, I guess. So it's only... I don't want it to set this as a gold standard, no.
Max?
And on the other hand, as when you have a setting like in Russia, I would be happy to have this test in the beginning to put the people to the right ward and give them the right treatment from the beginning. And even when I fail, I have time to find the missing 10%. Yeah?
Max?
Standard in terms of algorithm. It really depends where you are, what your current system is, what resources you have, and so on. And this will be like the standard operation procedure manual, an ongoing job to refine. So today, for a certain country, it may be algorithm A considered the best solution. 5 years later, it might be different. And in another country, it might be from the beginning different. So we need to be very careful to talk about the gold standard, and maybe it would be easier to say we develop algorithm for certain case scenarios.
Two quick questions. One, what needs to be done to clarify this growing evidence of genotypic and phenotypic discordance that's being seen? I find that very difficult to interpret when we have some results that are genotypically suggest resistance when phenotypically it's acceptable, and vice versa.
Who would like to comment on standard methods for discrepant resolution? Kanush? Ahman? Whoever.
No, this is one of the core questions, because this was a big problem for several years in the quality assurance rounds of the supranational laboratories, and a lot of discordance for and then it turned out it was bound to specific mutations. And now the question is, what do these mutations really mean clinically? And that's the problem. We need long-term clinical follow-up of the patients from whom these strains were isolated. And I have some data, but it's... Anyway, I think all laboratories struggle with this problem when it comes to have good clinical data. It's not evident. I don't have good clinical data for the thousands of strains that we have. So I suppose if more people take this question seriously, then we can solve it together. But
Max?
If we look a little bit, maybe 40 years back, the WHO guidelines from the 60s, it was clear at that time they measured MICs. And since at that time all these laboratories were still in the sanatorium, so they had access to patients to the lab under the same roof. Unfortunately, this is not any longer the case, and so there are different directions. However, over time, it became inconvenient to do so many MICs, and then there was the critical concentration in a way developed. And with the critical concentration and the critical proportion, to have only one concentration tested as a screening method. And we forgot that we actually, if we want to do gold standard, then we need to go back to MICs, and since we have our molecular, bring both together. and not compare a liquid system which has already limitations back then. We knew that. Because at that time we compared back then 460 with 7H10. And now, instead of going back to 7H10, Mitchell is compared to a 460. And this reminds me on a children's game when you have them all in a circle, you whisper black snake, it goes around, and then you have a white elephant. So, same thing, when you measure then what just is current, quote-unquote standard, over time, you will deviate. And that's why we need to make sure that we go back to a descriptive, meaning MICs, the interpretation is then different, and in addition, when we actually do this type of population analysis, we have now genotyping methodology available. So if you have a cluster of a rare mutation, and in this cluster you have 100, but actually it's only one strain, because it's an outbreak. So then you have actually 100 strains weighed more than what it actually should be for this rare mutation. So today we have many more tools available to characterize, and we certainly need to put effort into this approach to characterize more these strains and not jump from one liquid medium to another and leave these 1-3% discordant results at the side.
I think there's, at least in our evaluation studies, we've included ensuring that there's not mixed cultures doing sequencing of the relevant genes and doing MICs at least one should do. Knut, you had a comment?
You found a lot of strains in different parts of the world, and I have those, let's say, rare mutations or doubtful susceptibles or resistant strains found in Bolivia as well as in Ukraine and one in Nepal now. So I think it's not an outbreak. And when you test them down on, let's say, Löwenstein or whatsoever, then you see it's below the critical concentration, but it is high above for above the serum level you get. Yeah? When you in the dosage you give rifampicin today, you reach a peak level of 8 to 12 micrograms per milliliter, and the MIC is around 20, 30 micrograms per ml. Yeah? Yeah, 40 is a critical, then we would find it, but below this. Yeah. So it is above this, in a lung tissue, the concentration is a little bit higher, so, but this needs to be evaluated by clinical methods. Yeah.
Any other comments? Now, I want to thank everyone for coming to this interesting session and participating.